So we're on Daf Kuf Yud Gimel Amid Beis, I think. Let's see. Let's see where we could pick this up. Do you see where the lines begin to get a little bit narrow? And you should find something that says Amar Shmuel. You find that line? This is the last thing we did on Kuf Yud Gimel Amid Beis, Amar Shmuel. And Ta'uso Muteris. That was the last thing we did. No. Right? It's I guess you'd say two lines before it gets wide, if that helps. Right. So just to summarize, Shmuel made a distinction between Gezel, Goy, stealing from a Goy, and Ta'uso, and a Goy who made a mistake. And I believe we did this Gemara pretty thoroughly with all the different cases where a guy made a mistake. There was, let's just go over the four cases. I think we had four cases. We had the case of Shmuel, where Shmuel bought what was really gold, but he paid for it as if it were copper. You know, he paid a fraction of the price. There was a case of Rav Kahana, who purchased what really amounted to be 120 barrels of wine, and he paid for 100 barrels, and the guy did not catch him on the mistake. There was a case of Ravina, who told his Heisbacher, you know, his second in command, to rush and chop down those roots of the tree that are worth more. When they divided up the shutvas, he was a partner with a guy. And then we had the case of Rav Ashi, and Rav Ashi saw that there were certain grapes that had fallen over the boundary of the grape of the orchard, and he said to his Heisbacher, if the orchard is owned by a guy, just take them. And the Gemara says, how was he allowed to do that? And the answer is, he really intended to pay the guy, because otherwise it would have been a chil Hashem. And the last thing that we touched on before we parted last week was the question of whether you're allowed to deliberately, actively deceive a guy. In all the cases that the Gemara tells, all the stories, it would seem that the guy himself was responsible for the deception, meaning he could have done a better job and figured out exactly what was going on. And he could have known that he was being underpaid, for example. But would the halacha permit actively cheating a guy, deceiving a guy? And the answer to that is really a machlokas between Rashi and the Rosh. Because in the story of Shmuel, when he purchased that bar of gold and he paid for it as if it was copper, the Gemara seems to report that there was also some sort of deception in terms of how much money Shmuel forked over to this guy. The value, the price of copper would have been 4 zuzim, and that's what the guy was expected to receive, because l'shitaso, the guy was of the impression that what? That it was going to be copper. Now, Rashi learns, and here's where the Rosh disagrees, that Shmuel only presented 3 zuzim. So even if it was only copper, which was worth a lot more than that as gold, even so he didn't pay up the entire price. And the guy was fooled into thinking that he received the entire price of copper when he only received 3/4 of the price of town. The Rosh disagrees. The Rosh reads the Gemara differently. The Rosh says that when it says the arba zuzi, it doesn't mean the ivla lechad zuzi, that he subtracted a zuz, but rather that he added a zuz. In other words, at the value, the market value of copper, he should have been paying 3 zuzim, and instead he added a zuz to pay 4 zuzim. And the Rosh said, why would Shmuel do such a thing and add an extra zuz? Shmuel was afraid that maybe at some point the guy down the line would realize, hey, what did I sell him? I delivered gold. I didn't deliver copper. But then he would say, well, copper is only worth 3, and yet I received 4. So he would realize that Shmuel thought it was gold, and he paid an extra zuz. And again, you have to know exactly. Yeah, it didn't cover it, but question whether it was in the ratio of it at all. I'll read to you the language of the Rosh here. The Rosh says, "Asur lahatos es hagoy." You're not allowed to cheat and deceive the goy. Ela im ta mi'atzmo mutter. Again, assuming that there's no issue of chil Hashem. And Bir Hamaisa says the Rosh, what happened in the case? Shmuel nosan lo od zuz. He added an extra zuz based on the price of copper. The Asa came. Why did he do such a thing? Kidei she'im yisbar la goy achakach shu shel zov lo shel nechoshes. The goy's going to find out it was gold. Lo yalad bedaito. He shouldn't consider the possibility shehito ha'yisrael b'chavona that Shmuel deliberately deceived him. Because he'll assume that if the price of copper is only 3, why did Shmuel pay 4? Yachshov sheshmuel gam came tov. Shmuel also made a toz, and he thought that the price of gold was 1 extra zuz above copper. Kimoshe tov bazeh shenosan lo zuz acher. He also made a toz in terms of the value of gold.
Why doesn't he think he made a mistake and just paid an extra zuz for the copper? Why would he think?
Again, I don't know all the details that you have to work out. It was what the prices were and so forth and so on. But let's say it was a given that the copper was only 3. Why did Shmuel pay him 4? The answer is that Shmuel was trying to pay him for gold because that's indeed what he. But what's important for us, Rabosai, is that when we raise the question, is tos akum, tos goy, mutter, even if you deliberately and actively create that situation, well, that depends on Rashi and the Rosh. If you're like Rashi's pshat that Shmuel underpaid him, then Shmuel actively deceived the goy, thinking that right? If the goy mistakenly on his own came to the conclusion that he was selling copper when he was really selling gold, okay, that's the toast of the atzmo. He himself, the goy, came to that mistake. But if Shmuel underpaid him deliberately when he was supposed to deliver for copper 4 and he only delivered 3, and that's Rashi's pshat here. Let's just see the Rashi inside so you don't think I'm inventing it. But Rashi says, V'holo avdi, just 1 second, the ivlo le zuze. Now again, do you have on the side hagos, hagro? I have a different printing than you, so this is not going to help much. Do you have a tosis, dibra maschil, hechi miyayshe? Okay. So yeah, you have hagos, hagro on the bottom, I have it on the top. Okay, so let's see, we all have hechi di miyayshe? On the same. So if you draw a line straight across that all the way over to Rashi, you'll find a Rashi that says Ivla Le Zuzi. And Rashi says V'Oto Sacheres, that in addition to the fact that he mistakenly thought that he was getting paid for copper when really should be paid for gold, in addition there was a second She'ikev Zuz Midomov, that Shmuel held back a full zuz. V'hit ohu b'cheshbon. He deceived him not only in terms of the goods, you know, what merchandise was the purchase column, but also he deceived him in terms of the payment itself. And that would lead us to a conclusion that according to Rashi's pshat, Shmuel went as far as to actively deceive the guy. However, as I told you before, the Rosh doesn't accept that. And the Rambam paskins in Hilchos Gzeila Perek Yud Alef Osur Lahatos Es Hagoy Ela Imta Me'atzmo Mutter. So the Rambam and the Shulchan Aruch following the Rambam accept the sheet of the Rosh, in this case against Rash. Now again, I have to add one proviso to this whole discussion. We're talking about a situation where there's no Chil Hashem, and that really. Again, it's not for us today, but I just want to point out, as the mind, you know, is curious to go beyond the daf that we're learning, you know, you might wonder about various situations in which a guy made a toz. Would there be a point, would it be laudable or meaningful from a halachic perspective to return that to the guy when he made a mistake? For example, again, I'm not sure of all the details of the story, but I heard a story about Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky, that he, if a guy made a mistake, he would run around looking for the guy until he returned the money. And I would say that maybe what Rav Yaakov is thinking is Kiddush Hashem. That even if the guy is unaware of the fact that he was underpaid, for example, and he was deceived, but if you offer him that money, he says, wow, you know, Mikiamcha Yisrael, that the Jewish people are very special, and that Kiddush Hashem is what motivates a Gadol B'Yisrael to give back to a guy something which halakhically he's not required to do.
that how can you ever know in the future whether there will be a Chilul Hashem? Like, how can you know in the future the Goy does the
So that's what I'm suggesting, David, that I may not be able to know that there'll be Chilul Hashem. The Goy may never find out about it, but one thing I could guarantee you, there'll be a Kiddush Hashem. Mm. And for that itself, a person might be motivated to want to give this money back. And I'll mention the famous story, I'm sure you all know about Henry Feuerstein in Boston, when his manufacturing plant was burnt down. He continued to pay his workers for months afterwards.
Aaron Feuerstein.
I'm sorry. What's his first name?
Aaron.
No, not Aaron. Yeah. What was Henry's father? Was Aaron?
It wasn't Henry's father. It was his uncle.
Oh, his uncle Aaron?
You're talking to Bostonians.
Okay. In any event, why did he do such a thing? He wasn't required to pay his workers, but they weren't even working at the time. So contractually, he had no obligation, but it was a tremendous Kiddush Hashem to such a point where even the Sonei Yisrael couldn't even believe it, you know, and they praised Feuerstein. And my proof for that is that it got to the New York Times.
If you want to be a real Medayik,
that's the only edition of the New York Times that's kedai to buy, by the way, if you get a hold of it.
If you want to be real Medayik, the end of the Rashi is very strange. Because the end of the Rashi should really read, "He tov b'cheshbon shenasan gimel b'mokum dalad."
Yeah, what's the word lokach? You're saying. Yeah.
So, if you want to be medayik, you can say that the goy took 3 instead of 4. So he wasn't. Really,
you mean maybe Shmuel put 4 on the table,
and he really wasn't involved.
Right.
There must be Hito Kleshman. And how was he?
Then the word Hito becomes fun. Yeah. All right. You know what? We can fight this out. But I'm just telling you that all the Achronim here see in this machlokas between the Rosh and Rashi about exactly what happened in the case of Shmuel, not just a simple insignificant detail, but a very fundamental issue about how far Tos Hakum is mut.
With the same apply with, if you go and buy something, instead of using a credit card, you actually pay cash, or $20, and the thing's worth $15, and instead of giving you $5 change, it gives you $10 change,
right,
by mistake.
Right. That's exactly what we're talking about. That halachically, according to this sugya, again, I'm not paskening, it would be mutter, you could walk away with that money, but because of Kiddush Hashem, if you return that money... And Rav Yaakov went very far. I mean, you know the story about Rav Yaakov, that if the postman forgot in the post office to stamp the stamp and he received the letter, he would bring the stamp back to the post office. You know, we're talking, and this is a different madriga. This is what the Rambam would call tzaddikim me'ulim, you know. All right. Gufa. So we're up to the last line before it gets wide. Am I right? Wait a minute. Maybe... I'm wrong, just one second. Where does it say Gufa? Oh boy, this is not good. Where's Gufa? Fine. Okay, I'm looking for the word Gufa. Sorry, it's a little bit lower down on the page. That's all this we did. There it is. Okay, so we're going to count about 7 lines down from the wide lines, and you'll see the word Gufa. That's where we're up to.
In the middle.
Okay. Gufa, Amar Shmuel. We have the famous super principle of Shmuel that we learned on Amud Aleph, and that is Dina Malchusa Din. Now at this point, for quite a bit, including Daf Kufya Dalet Amud Aleph, the Gemara goes into great details about Dina de Malchusa Dina in terms of the individual who is appointed by the king, and he may very well be Jewish, to know exactly what he should be doing in collecting taxes. Because in some cases, the collection of taxes involves what I call a kapara hindle, if you know what I mean by that. You know, somebody becomes like the scapegoat. Like, let's say, for example, the government has to collect a certain sum of money, we'll call it X, in order to build a bridge. And the decision was made to collect from certain merchandise, let's say certain produce. Now, not everyone is even here. There may be certain Jews who already harvested that produce, they've already consumed it, and there's no possibility to collect the taxes from them. There are other Jews who haven't yet, you know, consumed their produce. So the question is, what are the bounds, what are the allowances that the tax collector has to collect the burden of the tax from Reuven and let Shimon get away with it? That would really be stealing from Shimon. If Reuven is the one who has to, there's no reason logically why Reuven should be paying more of a tax than Shimon. So within the context of the halacha recognizing and validating tax collection called Dina de Malchusa Dina, what does this tax collector do in this case? For example, is he allowed to collect the bulk of the tax from Reuven and then tell Reuven, go collect from Shimon, get reimbursed from Shimon for the amount of money that you put out? Or I'll give you another example. When they had to build a bridge, they would take a certain percentage of wood. Wood was considered an expensive commodity back in the day, from, let's say, one particular area, which is, in the Gemara's language, is called a bikar. We call it a valley. So that there's one valley, and the tax collector goes down to the farmers or the tree producers in that valley, and he collects from that valley. Technically, what he should really be doing is going to each valley and proportionally collecting that wood from everyone. Let's say there are 10 wood owners here in this valley, and there are another 10 in the other valley. We should take the total sum that he has to collect and divide it by 20. But yet the tax collector doesn't want to go through the whole hassle of knocking on everyone's door and going from one bicker to the other. And by the way, the distance between one bicker and another might be a very extensive distance. So to what extent do we give the tax collector a leeway, allowing him to collect from one bicker with the assumption that the members of that bicker would get reimbursed if they make a claim against the members of another bicker? And where does the responsibility fall? On whose shoulders? So they're just giving a little bit of an overview of the Gemara. Let's go into detail now.
So you're talking about a Jewish tax collector.
A Jewish tax collector. I meant to say that. If I forgot to say that, I apologize. Okay. Amar Rava. Rava says Teda. First of all, Rava says that the way that the Jewish people live, you know, the customs by which they live, would itself be indicative that we accept Shmuel, Dina Malchus Dina. And the argument comes from the opposite. You know, you can prove that Shmuel's halach of Dina Malchus Dina is correct, because if you assume it's not correct, then we cannot justify the way we live. Why is that so? Tate, I'll prove it to you. De Katli Dikle, what happens is the kings, within the context of tax collection, will cut down wood from Jewish people who owned, you know, those orchards of trees that have wood in it. And what would they do with their wood? The collection, the government, was for the sake of Gashrei Gishrei, which means creating bridges. Now, watch this. If we reject Shmuel of Dina Malchus Dina, if the halacha doesn't recognize the validity of tax collection, then basically when the government will collect from a Jew his wood, and that's not valid, then what status does that wood have? And this we discussed at great length last week. It's stolen goods. Now, if you take stolen goods and you use it to build a bridge, then the law is that the halacha doesn't allow you to benefit from stolen goods. And yet, Vavrina and Alayu, we travel across the bridge, and we're benefiting from the bridge. Again, maybe if you're a brisker, you know, you get to the bridge and you all start shaking, you get nervous. Maybe there's stolen wood here, and I'm not going to go across the bridge. But the Gemara is not assuming that we're, you know, paranoid briskers. So we're assuming we're crossing the bridge. How can we do so? And the answer is because Dina de Malchus Dina, because this is not stolen, but rather the halacha recognizes the monetary rights of the government to collect this tax and cut down trees for the purpose of building the bridge. There's no gzeli. That's what Rav wants to say. And we can always imagine and guess that if Rav is going to make a statement, who's going to argue against him? Abaye, right? Abaye is always the Bar Pluta of Rav. And Abaye becomes the skeptic over here. And he says, you know what? There's no proof. Even if I bracket the principle of Dina Malchusa Dina, Amalei Abaye Dilma, I could answer. There's another reason halachically why even if I grant you that the wood is stolen wood, you're still allowed to cross over the bridge. And the answer is Mishum Diyayish Lahu Minayu Marayhu. Marayhu means the owners, the Jewish owners of those trees, the wood that was cut down for the Gesher, for the thing. They were Misyayish. Not because halachically the king has valid rights to confiscate the trees, the wood, but because they don't have a chance in a million to get back, to get reimbursed for their trees, so they are misyayish. Now, mind you, it would seem, and that's the way Rashi learns this sugya, that Abaye is working with the following premise, which itself is quite questionable, and that is that Yeush is kona b'gzela. This is a sugya back on Daf Samach Vav. And there are two opinions about this question. According to one opinion, Yeish itself is not sufficient to create a kinyan. You need Yeish and Shinui Rishus. So we're going to have to see whether or not the confiscation on the part of the guy, of the Malchus, to build this bridge, does that constitute Shinui Rishus? Amole, so Rava turns to Abaye and defends his original proof, and he says, Ilav, Ilo, if not for Dina Malchus Adini, Hechi Miyashe. Now there are two ways of reading that Hechi Miyashe. One way of reading it is the way Rashi wants to read it, and that is that Yeish itself, in and of itself, would not be enough to remove Gzela. And even though now the government, in a sense, owns the bridge, and that would constitute Shinui Rishus, so it's not just Yeish, but it's Yeish together with Shinui Rishus. Everybody agrees that Yeish with Shinui Rishus creates Kinyan Gzeila in the full sense. But the answer is, and again, for this we'd have to really study in depth the Sugya on Daf Samach Vav, there's something called Rishus HaRabim. Rishus HaRabim, again, it depends how you define it, it's publicly owned property, which either means that everybody owns it or nobody owns it. Let's assume that nobody owns it, because no single individual can claim that he owns this bridge. It's owned by some sort of abstract enterprise called the Rabin.
State.
The state, okay. But not the state insofar as it represents you and I, but the state as an abstract entity. You know, it's not something that commands bailus and ownership. So therefore, there's never a Shini Rishus. That's the way Rashi is interpreting the sugya. However, there's another interpretation which seems to be the proponent of this interpretation is the Rashba. And basically, according to the Rashba, what Rava was saying is something totally different. He wasn't talking about Yeish Bechdi Lo Kani, that Yeish in and of itself is not sufficient for a Kenyan. He's focused on the Yeish itself. And he asks Abaye the following question. Again, all this is implicit in two words, Hechi Miyayish. Why would a person be Miyayish? And the answer is, the reason why he's Miyayish is because of Dina, the Malchus of Dina. That's the Yeish itself, which allows us to travel across the bridge, because the Gazlan is Kona B'Yeish, that itself would only be a reality if I grant you that Dina, the Malchus of Dina. So I'll read to you the language of the Rashba. Ilu lo hoya din ha-malchus. And you'll see also similar things in Tosfos Din Maskil Hechi, the last Tosfos on the page. Ilu lo hoya din ha-malchus din lo hoya miyashim klal. The reason why the people give up is because they don't think that they could undermine the legality of din ha-malchusa. The afshes ha'etzim atzmam lo savru l'kabel kevichinas al pi ha'malchus. Even though, what chance do they have to get back their wood from the malchus? Mikomakom yucholim hem li akev mikola yisraelim lavar alehem. It's unbelievable. These Jews, whose trees were confiscated by the government as a tax collection for building the bridge, have a right to literally stand at the entrance to the bridge and say to every Jew who wants to go by, you have no rights to use this bridge because the bridge was built with our stolen pieces of wood. And the reason why they have no right to do so is only because of Dina Malchus Adina. So even if I grant you that they're Miyayish, that the Jews from which the wood was confiscated have no ray of hope or optimism of ever getting back their trees from the government, so certainly they're Miyayish. But he's saying that the efficacy of that Yeush is built on, is a result of Dina Malchus Adina. Because if you don't recognize that Yeush as a valid Yeush, meaning if you don't assume that the government made a valid Kinyan and really legally, halachically owns those trees, then the bridge is not allowed to be used by any Yisrael. And the Yisraelim have a right to say that these are our trees. You want to go across the bridge, you'll have to pay a bridge toll.
But the ruler could be a despot.
And we're not going to accept the easy pass.
The ruler might be a despot. It's not by general agreement, but...
Correct.
So it wouldn't fit this case. Yeah.
You're asking whether it's general agreement or not.
Yes, yeah.
So he's saying the following, that it's only general agreement that most Jews will agree that they don't have rights to that bridge only because of the validity of the Kinyan of the Malchus. If there was no valid Kinyan Malchus, they're not going to get it back from the Malchus. That they have no chance. You know, Henry VIII is not going to give them back their money. But what they do have a chance is to go to their Yiddish friends and say to them, you want to cross this bridge? This bridge is owned by us because there's no valid Yeush, because Dina Malchus Alav Dina Hu. And therefore you have to pay us a toll to use the bridge. The reason why, says the Rashi and Tosfos, that you don't have rights to build them is because the Kinyan is valid. And why is the Kinyan valid? Because of Dina de Malchus. The Gemara is not happy with this. The Gemara says, I still don't see why we're allowed to use this bridge. Vaholo ka'avdi kida Omar Malk. He says the following, that the tax collectors are not living up to the mandate that they got from the king. This throws a whole other element into the sugya. What did the king mandate the tax collectors? Did he say collect from this particular neighborhood? No. The Malka Omar, the king, said to these tax collectors, when he commissioned them, he said, Zilu, go ahead. Vikitlu mikol bagi. Bagi is this bikkur that I told you before, the valley. And the Aramaic word for bikkur is bagi. Kitlu means cut down the trees, mikol bagi. You know, let's get an equal, fair representation of all the trees in the entire province, so that even those who are in a faraway valley will also be contributing to this tax. There's no reason why they should be less responsible for paying the tax than the people in this local, close bikkur. The inhu, and yet these tax collectors, because they don't want to go through this hassle of traveling from one bicker to the other and collecting the wood, also they went ahead v'katlu michad baga, and they only collected from one. They zeroed in on one particular valley. They collected a massive amount of trees from that valley, which is disproportionate and it's unfair. That certainly, therefore, constitutes gzela. So it means, if we want to activate the principle of Dina Malchus Adina, and therefore undermine gzela, we need two things. Number one, we need some sort of a mandate from the king, which is a valid, compassionate mandate that makes sense, logically. We've got to build a bridge. But number two, we have to also guarantee that those who are implementing the actual tax collection are fulfilling the mandate they got from the king in such a way that everyone is contributing, every bicker gives over its wood. But that's not what they're doing. So the Gemara comes up with a brand new chiddush, halachically, in terms of this Jewish tax collector who's collecting the wood. Shlucha de Malka Kimalka Vilo Tarach. He, the tax collector, is called the Shliach of the Melech, meaning he's the long arm of the king, and the king is not expecting him, this tax collector, to do this tircha, but rather they can take everything from one particular bikkur and concentrate and focus all their attention on that close and relatively easy tax collection process in that particular valley. And therefore, they're doing it kidasu kidin, meaning they're absolutely legal, and they are fulfilling the king's will. I, the king, said collect from all the bikkos. So that means that the other members of the other bikkos will be subject to a lawsuit, so to speak. Meaning, the contributors to this tax in the local bikkur will go to the members of the other bikkur with a claim that they have to be reimbursed, because why shouldn't you contribute to this building of a bridge? And therefore, if they decide that they're not going to go through the whole hassle of collecting reimbursement from the other members who haven't chipped in for this tax collection, inu they afsid anafshayu, that's their decision. And the law allows the shliach of the melech to do so and throw the ball into the court of the local bikkur members who are giving the entire tax collection. The ball is in their court. They now have to deal with the situation as is. They have legal rights to be reimbursed. Why should they single-handedly, carry the burden of this tax? But that's up to them. If they want to go through this process, v'vakasha, they really are legally protected by the law. Iboiluhu le'inkot mikuli bagi, because every member of every single bikkur should be participating. U'mishkal dami, and therefore they here, who contributed to the tax collection, have rights to mishkal dami, to collect money as reimbursement for the trees that they contributed to this collection for the building of the bridge. Obviously, they can't collect and be reimbursed for that chiluk that they have. You know, let's say it's every single member of every single bikkur is meant to pay to contribute five trees. You know, on five trees, he can't expect any reimbursement. But anything above and beyond the five trees, the wood of the five trees, that he can claim. But the chiddush here of the Gemara is that the burden now is placed on the shoulders of each individual contributor who paid his tax to get reimbursed from those who did not pay the tax.
If he's going to get reimbursed in money for the trees that he gave, then how do you use the rules as to what happens to the value? Is it called shas gzela if I go and collect money that value?
No, I don't think it's gzela, because again, now the Gemara is maintaining that dina the malchus dina, and the shliach of the melech is like the melech. So in that sense, the shliach is doing what he has to do. So there's no gzela here, and therefore you're allowed to cross the bridge. You do have monetary rights to get reimbursed, but there's nothing stolen about the wood.
So then how do you determine what the right value is? It's saying the tree, the value of trees go down between now and I go and collect. Do I get to say, well, it was worth $100 when the day they chopped my trees down, but now it's worth 50, you still have to pay me 100. Or no, I'll pay the value today.
Let's think about that. I mean, what?
Shuma de dina.
You shoot at the dining, maybe, you know. But what do you want to say?
The melech hasn't said that they are.
Who said?
The collector is not carrying out the instructions of the melech. The melech is virtually saying, go to every valley and collect from there. And they're going to one valley.
Right.
So that's not carrying out his instructions.
So wait, so you're disagreeing with the Gemara in general. Yeah, that's your kasha. Okay, fine. But let's just answer Yechiel's question and then we'll get back to your kasha. Okay, fine. So Yechiel's asking, how much can the individual members who could participate in the tax, how much can they demand in return? It would seem to me, and I don't know if this answers your question, that the answer to that question relies in the bridge itself. Meaning, what we have to do is the lawyers will have to work out a value of the bridge and figure out what, in monetary terms, is the individual tax to contribute, depending on how, per capita, how many people are contributing to this tax. And as I said before, if there are 10 people, it's one price. If it's 20 people, it's a different price, etc., etc. And that price is the amount that it takes to build this bridge. And even if you may say the price fluctuates, but that was the tax. And the tax is set at a certain price. Now, as far as your point, Alfie, well, why does the tax collector have a right to do this? I don't think the Gemara asks that question. The Gemara is just assuming that that's the way the king operates. So that maybe in each country it might be different, but in Bavel, back at that time, the king gave a certain leeway, made it a little bit easier for the tax collectors, and within the context of Dina Malchus Adina, that's valid. Omar Rava. Now again, we have another issue about collecting the brunt of the tax from one group and the other group gets away. As I said before, we're talking now about taxing produce, and the produce comes in different stages, and there are different owners of fields that will you know, will harvest their produce and market it at a different time period. And so it's not like everybody in the whole country, all the farmers, you know, consume their produce on one particular day. It's going to happen over the course of time. So man de mishtakach bevei dori. Bei Dori is the place where the tax was collected. It's called the Beis HaGronos. That's where the, you know, the harvest was brought in for to the granary for winnowing and so forth and so on. And now Pura Mansa de Malka, you know, who's ever stuck, you know, whoever gets caught with his produce in the granary, that's where the tax is going to be collected by this Jewish tax collector. We'll call him the Gabbai of the king. And therefore, there are many other members of the community that have already consumed their produce. They're not going to be taxed, and this becomes fair. And the answer is that each one of the members of the community will be subject to a lawsuit, so hopefully it doesn't have to come down to a lawsuit, in which they will be sued. All right, but I'm looking for a lighter word than sued, but they will be charged, if you will, legally charged, to make up the difference. Well, now we have a problem, and the problem is something called an oris. Now let's try and understand that when you have a piece of property, let's say in the case of an agricultural society, you have what's called Oretz Shemotzia Peros, or Tvuah. So you may have many different people throughout the land who own the land, and therefore they are to be taxed. They are being taxed on the produce based on their ownership of the land. The case of the Oris, which again loosely translates into English as a sharecropper, is a little bit more complicated. Because the sharecropper really only has a share in the produce. He doesn't have any ownership, or what we call shutfis, in the land itself. So if you look at the land, the Oris has no ownership in the land. And that's what Rava wants to know, whether or not the law that applies to the owners of the various lands, or the shutfim that own parts of the land, should be applied to the aris itself. And he says no. He says, Hani Mili, when do we apply this rule that they're all equally responsible because they're all considered shutfim in the land, and therefore their produce will be taxed, and we have to make sure that this tax is collected fairly and distributed equally amongst all the shutfim that's only shutfim. Avala Risa, but a person who's a sharecropper, and he doesn't own anything in the land itself. He just gets rights to collect a certain percentage of the produce, whether it's a third, whether it's half, whatever it might be. Then in such a case, let's say that the only one who's left with produce that can be taxed and collected is the Oris Nebuch. So in such a case, the Gabbai, again this Jewish Gabbai, who's collecting according to the validity of Dina Malchusadina, and he wants to collect from the Oris, is Arisuse Hudekomapik. The Oris doesn't have ownership rights in the Sud itself. He's only getting part of the Tvu, as we said before, and that's payment for his work. In such a case, the Malchus has no right, according to the Halach at least, to collect a tax from the Oris. He's not taxable, because the nature of this tax is not a tax on the produce, but the produce is being taxed as a benefit from the land itself, and the primary object or mammon that's being taxed is the ownership of the.
So what is the Oris supposed to do?
What does the Gabbai do?
What is the Oris supposed to do? Yeah.
No, what we're saying is that the Oris is not going to be taxed. Now, if he is taxed,
exactly.
If he is taxed, then that's gzela. Then that's not halakhically valid. But I thought you were asking a slightly different question, Michael. What does the Gabbai, who's from a Yid, you know, he's a religious Jew, what does he do? He's got to produce to the Melech a certain value of produce for the tax collection, and the only one he finds there in the Beis HaGronos is the Oris, and he has no rights according to Halacha to collect from the Oris.
Oh, hold on, if the Oris only gets 10% and the other gets 90%, he can take the 90%, surely.
It's not there, though. It's not there.
Well, that's what we're saying. We're saying that the owners are not there. The only portion that hasn't been consumed is that of the Oris. Everything else has been consumed.
10% is there.
He was at the wrong time.
So again, the Gavite Stocker is now in a very sensitive situation here, because he's caught between a rock and a hard place. He's caught between his responsibility vis-a-vis the Melech, and he's liable to the Melech, and yet he has a responsibility to Halacha, and Halacha says it's not fair to collect this tax from the Oris.
If he seizes the land.
Well, presumably the king's edict is to collect from the land owners.
Correct. So in that case, then the Gavai will be able to say to the king, what am I supposed to do in this case?
But that's not correct. Because, well, at least according to Rashi, he's able to collect the share of the Oris. The Oris has to pay his own tax too. Now, he's not an owner of land, but he still has to pay a share. So it's not just owners that we're taxing.
Right, but
he can't take the Balabais' share from the Oris's crop.
Correct. So what does he do? What does he do in that case? So that's what I think Michael is pointing out, that maybe in that case the king will stretch the or present the edict in that way. Amar Rava.
You can use the same thing you said before.
Rabosai, because the time is late, let me just try to get to the punchline here of the shiur. Amar Rava, if you don't mind. Bar Masa. A bar masa mi'avit. Now the word mi'avit is a very powerful word in this context, and that's called an avut in the biblical language, otherwise known in our language as a mashkon. So now what happens? The gabai is collecting an enormous amount of tax from one particular city, and that's going to cover the tax for members of a different city. And the question is, does the gabai who's collecting these taxes have a halachic right, a legal right, according to halacha, to take a mashkon from the members of one city to guarantee that they will reimburse the members of the other city? In other words, what happens is the following. On the one hand, the members of this city are going to pay the tax, but they're going to pay an unfair proportion of the tax. There's got to be some way, according to Rava, that the gabai, in order to guarantee that the tax will be equally distributed and being paid even by members of the other city, there will be a mechanism that it will guarantee that the members of the other city will indeed pay up. And the question is, does the gabai, in order to guarantee that, have the right to confiscate an avud, to go into someone's house and take away his, kitchen table, his dining room table, as a mashka? So let's read Rava. Rava says, bar masa mi'ayit. I'll read to you the translation. He says, "Rashoy gabay amisim shalamelech lemashkein ben ir zu avur ben ir chavero she yishalim es misa." Shalom yishalim es misa. Shalom shilem es misa. Sorry. Okay. So the answer is that he's allowed to collect this mashkon, but hani mili. But there's a very, very strong restriction to this. And what is that? Debarla aara. V'charga dehayshata. Okay, let's try to translate these words. The burla of ara means the peros of the karka. Okay, so we're talking about a tax on fruits, on merchandise, on produce. V'charga, and this is per capita. Karga means that it's per head. Dehayshata of this year. So again, we're taxing the produce of this year's produce per capita. Aval shata dechalif. In the case of last year's produce, hoil the ifayis malka, since the gabai has already given a certain amount of money that would satisfy and pacify the king. In other words, at the end of the year, he made a calculation of what's the sacha kol that the malchus should be collecting here from this tax. And at this point, hamas adayin lo shilmu shalohu is chalif. Okay, what does this mean? Since the year passed already, that's Cholev, is at that point he can no longer collect a mashkon. So basically, if he collected a mashkon, that mashkon will guarantee that the members of the other city, in order to get back that mashkon in return, they'll pay the money. But let's say, for example, he hasn't yet gotten to collect a mashkon. So the Chiddush of Rava here is that it works on an annual basis. And you could only collect a mashkin for this year's taxes. But if the melech has already been satisfied with whatever collection of taxes, whatever amount was collected, then going into the next year, you start a whole new cheshbon. And you can't collect a mashkin on last year. So it means that the members of the other city are not bound to pay this tax. Again, halachically they should be paying the tax, but there's no mashkon that's going to guarantee. The Omar, I'm sorry. In this case, Yechiel, I just want to get to a certain point, and then maybe next week what's today?
Tuesday.
Today's Tuesday. So let's leave a little bit, you know, so that you'll have. I'm whetting your appetite, so that you'll come back on Thursday. Okay. The Omar Rava, Hani the Dire Dori, those people who have animals. And what they do is they let their animals graze into other fields. Again, how they're allowed to do that, we'll have to see. B'toch ha-tchum, if it's within the tchum, then asur likach mehem. In other words, let's say goyim want to sell you animals that are grazing within the limits of the city. Do you have to assume that maybe the guy is stealing a Jewish animal? And the answer is yes. Also likach mehem. My timer, why? Mishum dema'arva chevasa demasa. Because there's a tarovis here, a mixture in which the animals of the Jews, chevasa demasa, the local Jews within the city, Bahadayu, are mixed in with the animals of the goyim. So this guy, John Paul Jones, is selling you an animal from his herd, and we're afraid that maybe one of the animals that is owned by a Jew has wandered into that area, and the guy took the animal and assumed it was his, whether deliberately or by accident. But chutz l'tchum, but if the animals are being sold outside the city limits, muta likach mehem, then we don't have to worry that this animal might be stolen goods that belongs to a Jew. And the reason for that is because, as a general rule, we don't assume that the Jewish owners of animals will allow their animals to go unsupervised as far as leaving the limits of the city. Meaning, they can't control their animals within the city limits, but once the animals travel beyond the limits of the city, then they make sure to rope in their animals. Omar Rava, im hayu bailim meradfim achrehem, if they, even outside the city limits, they see the purchaser who wants to buy this animal from a guy, he sees that the Jewish people are running around looking for their animals outside the city limits. Is afilu chutz l'tchum asur. The fact that the Jew is running out trying to get a hold of his animal, that's proof that the animal might indeed belong to the Jew, and therefore it's stolen, and you shouldn't buy it. Machriz Rav Avitem Rav Huna. Now, whenever you see the word machriz, you mean that this is a very important halacha, in this case in monetary law, and it's going to have a tremendous impact on the laws that govern relationships, monetary relationships between the Jews and the non-Jews. So that's called Machriz Rav. It's a very dramatic statement in the Gemara. And this statement was made famous, or was publicized, in both directions. One direction is the Salkin Li'ela, amongst those who went from Bavel up to Eretz Yisrael. Eretz Yisrael is considered higher than the other nations. And also Dinachtin Litata, and including those who left Eretz Yisrael and went down to Bavel. All those, whether it's the Jews going in that direction or that direction, had to know this halacha. That's how basic this halacha is. And let me give you an introduction to this sugya. The law is, according to Torah, that you need how many witnesses in order to supply evidence and take money out of... You need two. in the laws of what's called a kusim in this Gemara, some sort of a branch of non-Jews, again we have to see who the kusim are, one witness is sufficient. Now there are two issues here, one of which the Gemara is going to cover here and another elsewhere. First issue is, in general, is a Jew allowed to testify in a non-Jewish court? The Gemara is assuming here that if those courts operate within the context of what we spoke about, Dina Malchus Adina, then you're allowed to testify in that court. But there's another issue here. Supposing you're testifying against a guy. Now, the law is within the Beis Din Shel Kusim that one witness is sufficient. But halachically, that Jew who is now the defendant is not obligated to pay. The courts of the Kusim are going to force him to pay based on your testimony as a single witness. So the Gemara says, Hai Bar Yisrael, this Jew who has testimony against another Jew, the Yoda Sadusa Lakusi, and his testimony would support the claim of the plaintiff who's now a non-Jew, the Lo Tavumine, okay, we'll get back to that in a minute. In other words, the Kusim have not subpoenaed this Jew into Beis Din. If they did that, then it gets a lot more complicated. But Azil Vishayidle Bidine de Kusi, if he went on his own volition to testify against a Jew in such a way that in the Beis Din Shel Kusim, based on his testimony, they're going to force the Yisrael to cough up and pay the money, Al Yisrael Chavri against another Jew, Mishamtinanle, we're going to put him into Nidu. This is something that is equivalent to utilizing another court system, a secular non-Jewish court system, for the sake of forcing a Jew to pay when the Jew doesn't have to pay. My timer, the inu mafke mamona the goyim are willing to force someone to pay. And here we move to Kuf Yudalad Amun Aleph. Afuma dechad, based on the testimony of one witness. And why is that against the Jewish law? Because the Torah says, Lo yakum eid echad b'ish. But rather, al pishnayim eidim yakum davar. We require a minimum of what? Of two witnesses. And now, this Jew, who's the defendant, is going to be forced to pay up based on the testimony of one Jew, which is anti-halachic. But lo hamaron ela chad. But what if there are two Jews who could testify together? I will betray if there are two witnesses. Lo, this halacha doesn't apply, but rather they can go ahead and testify in a non-Jewish court, because then, even had it been in a Jewish court, the same result, the same halacha would apply, and the Jew would have to pay. V'chad nami lo amar, and even in the case where there's only one witness, we're not going to prohibit him from giving that testimony, Ella, unless it's one of these secondary courts, not the real courts. There were two categories of Kusi courts. One is called Bedine de Magista. Magista means the outlying small villages, and there they accepted that one witness is enough to force someone to pay. So they relied on the testimony of one witness. So in those courts, which are out in the B'nai Kfarim, there you're not allowed to testify if you're only one witness. Aval Bei Davar, Davar is considered the ultimate, city courts, the main courts of the country, and there, the Inu Nami, they too, the non-Jewish courts in the largest cities, Chad Amomasa Shadule, they will not accept the testimony of one witness, except what they will do is they will rely on the testimony of one witness to require that the defendant take an oath. Now again, there are many questions we could ask here on this sugya, but the basic, shall I say, simple pshat in the Gemara is that this is not against halacha. Because although the halacha does not allow a person to forcing a person to pay based on the testimony of what? Of one witness. However, if the one witness does testify against the person, then even a Jewish court will rely on the testimony of one witness to force the defendant to take what? To take a shvuah. So this is not antithetical to the halacha. Omar Rav Ashi wants to tell us a story. Ki Avina Bei Rav Huna, when I was studying under the tutelage of Rav Huna, Iboilon, we had a question that we asked him. Adam Chashuv, What about a person who has a tremendous reputation, he has an outstanding status in the community, and the non-Jewish courts will rely on him as if he was two Aden. The mafki mamonu afume. And even in the basic, you know, city courts, the courts of the goyim that rely on two witnesses, in this case, they will rely on the testimony of one aid. Is then, what should we say about this case? Since now they, the non-Jewish courts, will rely on one testimony, then lo iboile lasude, he should not testify against the Jew, because now they're going to rely on his testimony and force that Jew to pay. O Dilma, or shall we say something else? Kevan di Adam Chashavu, lo matzi mishtamit lehu, umatzi lasude. Since this person is considered by the goyim to be such a person of stature and status, they won't let him get away with it. They're going to pressure him, and they're going to threaten him. I don't know what they're going to do to him if he doesn't come. If he doesn't come to testify, and therefore Matzi Lasude, we can allow him to testify. Teiku, and the Gemara leaves this as a suffix. I'm just going to take another 2 minutes to try to get to the Mishnah, and then I want to read to you a fascinating footnote here. Omar of Ashi. Hai Bar Yisrael, the Zoven Le Ara, a Jew who sold his property, his real estate, Le'ove Kol Chovim, to a non-Jew. And there's a Jew who owns a neighboring piece of land. Now, the law is that if I own a land next to yours, I'm not allowed to just sell it on the open market, but rather what law kicks in here? Dina de Bar Mitzvah. I have to sell it to you because you want to expand your farm in such a way that now you can farm a greater tract of land. Here in this case, the Jew wants to sell his karka not to another Jew, which he can't do without getting the okay from the neighbor, but he wants to sell it to a guy. Debar Yisrael Chavre is Mishamtinale. We will put a whammy on him and we'll put a nidui on him and excommunicate him. Why? My timer? And Lechora, the answer is because we're going to apply the principle of Dina Debar Mitzvah that the Jew next to you has rights, first rights, to buy your land. I mean, he doesn't have to pay less than what the market value is, but at least give him a shot at purchasing. So Gemara says, no, that can't be true. E name, if you're going to tell me Mishum Dina de Bar Metzra, if you're going to tell me that when a person sells a karka, then he has to give first rights to his neighbor, and that's derived by the Gemara earlier in this Masechta from the Pasuk Garsisa HaYoshev HaTov, and therefore we're going to put this Jewish merchant who's selling his land to a guy into Nidui, that's not so. Why? And for this we have to see a sugya later on. How does Bar Mitzvah work? Does Bar Mitzvah create a right to the neighbor to demand that he gets first rights to purchase the land? Or does Bar Mitzvah work in a different way? And it means that the buyer has a responsibility before he buys the land to offer the neighbor first rights to buy the land. And that's what the Gemara quotes, give me a minute, a sugya in Bav Metzia. That's not going to apply to a guy. That's why the Gemara is going to have a problem here. Ve'amar mar, didn't we learn in Masechta Bava Metzia Kuf Ches Amid Beis that Zovin Me'ove Kochavim, if a person buys land from a guy, and this land is next to the Meitzar, the borders, the boundaries of his friend who's Jewish, the Zovin, or even in the second case, Li'ove Kochavim, the Jew is selling in this case land to a non-Jew, and that land that he's selling is next door to his fellow Jew. Leka Mishum Dina de Bar Mitzvah. The Din of Bar Mitzvah doesn't apply. Why? Because, and I'm going to read to you again the summary of Rashi here, he says, Kishakona Migai, when he buys this land from a guy, etzem zesh economy menu, misalko min Yisrael asamachlo, yeshba mishum yoshavito. So if he's buying from a guy, that's great. We want to buy land from a guy. And the fact that he's buying land from a guy next to a Jew, that's wonderful. So we'll have two Jewish neighbors. But what about the second case? Ukshamochel goy. But what about the Jew who owns? He's a neighbor who owns the neighborly karka, and now he wants to sell to a goy. The answer is, according to the statement in the Gemara Bab Metzia, Ikar din bar mitzvah hu al halokeach. Bar mitzvah does not bequeath a right to the neighbor, but rather it imposes a responsibility on the buyer. The buyer is not allowed to buy this, knowing full well that there's a neighbor, you know, boundary Jew, without giving that Jew first rights, first dibs, to buy the karka. But in this case, where the lokeach is a guy, there is no bar metzra. So again, the din of bar metzra, according to this Gemara Bab Metzia, is a responsibility on the buyer. Shelo yikne liatzmo, but rather he has to give rights to his neighbor to buy that land. But if the mocher himself is selling it to a guy, then the story is different, because then the buyer is a guy. Ella, says the Gemara, you misunderstood the halacha of Rav Ashi. Why is it that a Rav Ashi said that you deserve a nidui for selling this land to a guy? Diamrinan lei, because the neighbor has a right to say to the Yisrael who's selling it, Arbeis li aria amitri, what you've done is you've placed a lion on my boundary line, meaning you've now given me a guy as my neighbor, and I don't want to tolerate this guy as a neighbor. So the Jew has a responsibility of not causing the, shall we call it, the inconvenience or the discomfiture of the Jew who lives next door to him to have to live now next door to a guy. It's therefore, if he goes ahead and he does so, forgetting about the din of bar metzra, there's no din of bar metzra, mishamtinan lei, we put him into nidri, adekabala lei, until he accepts himself. The mocher, I say, has to accept himself to pay kol onse di isa mechamose, any damage that the neighbor Jew will suffer as a result of the fact that the guy bought the next land over and he becomes his neighbor. Those losses have to be compensated for by the mocher himself. Okay, now Yechiel, let's see if we can go back to the Gemara that we ran through before, and see if in the next 2-3 minutes we can answer your question. So Omar Rav, Rava says the following: Hani didare dori betochatchu. So if he has animals that he wants to buy from a guy within the tchum of the city, then he has to assume that maybe one of those animals is a stolen animal from a Jew. Go ahead, Yechiel. What was your question?
I was actually thinking the case before that.
The case before that. Sorry.
I just didn't understand the Metzias, so I didn't see what's going on.
Bama Rav, bar masra a bar masra mi'avit. That if the tax collector wants to collect from the members of one city at the expense of the members of the other city, then he could say to the members of the other city, I want to receive from you a mashkon. Let me read to you the translation. He says, "Rashoi gaboy amisim shal melech lemashken ben ir avor ben ir chavero shaloshilem es misav." To accept a mashkon. What's a mashkon in English?
Security.
Excellent. Afshehu atzmo kvar pora es chovoso. What does that mean? Afshehu atzmo kvar pora es chovoso. So what we have to figure out here, that's what Yechiel is correct.
The word mashkon sounds like something you're going to return. He's not returning, he's giving it to the king. He collected it and gave it to the king.
Oh, I didn't understand that he gave it to the king. I understood that he gave it to the members of the city who were paying up the tax for the other members, for the members of the other city. So let's look it over again. I realized that, as I was saying the shiur, that if we got stuck on this, that would be the end of the shiur for today. And I promised a fellow by the name of Elio Miller, who wants to join us on Thursday, that we'll start the Mishnah on Thursday.
Oh, right. Next one. On all these things, you can say Shluch the Malcha.
Right. So that's what this whole sugi is about. When do we apply the rule of Shluch the Malcha? When do we not apply? All right, let's stop for Mincha. I'll make myself a note.
Just cut the mustard.